Welcome to the Your Creativity Podcast. We have long-form conversations featuring incredible creatives from all walks of life, sharing their unique journeys and more with our quirky panel of hosts, featuring Dylan Mazziotti, Steve Hatch, Terry Burden, and Jessica Richardson.
Welcome back, everybody, to Your Creativity. We are visiting with another individual up north. I think this is about our third or fourth interview with a Canadian. This guy is named Brad Goss, like Boss. That's how I checked the spelling with him, and I was correct. He is best known for reading his rejected children's books on TikTok and YouTube. Brad Goss, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. How's your Tuesday going?
It's good. I had another podcast earlier, and the guy didn't show up, so that was fun. But other than that, I'm actually just putting the finishing touches on a Kickstarter today, so I've been pretty busy.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're always working on something. You've got how many of I keep on seeing different numbers. How many total of these books do you have put together?
150.
150. Yeah, I heard 140, and then I heard like 160. So I just
sometimes I just make numbers up, you know, because they sound good. So it's really only 12, but no, I'm
just depends who you talk
to. It's 150. It's technically 151, but the 151st one isn't quite published yet. So
I was listening to a couple other podcasts that you did to kind of get a little more background for us to chat about.
It's all lies. It's all lies.
All lies.
Yeah.
Okay. So you'll set the record straight or make it worse?
Well, yeah, I'll dig into the lie even further. We'll see what happens.
Alrighty.
Let's go.
Well, you're telling the guy about the process that, you know, from the idea, getting it together, and sometimes it could take an hour and other times much, much longer. Kind of give us the quick run of, you know, when you get the idea to when it's to the page.
So it usually starts with an idea for a title. And the title is usually very indicative of what the book's going to be about. Right. And oftentimes I have different processes, but I have cartoonists that work for me. I don't draw my own images. So what I'll do is I'll write like a very loose page by page rhyming scheme of what I think the book should be. And then I'll come up with a quick, you know, one liner description of what the illustration for that page should look like. And I'll come up with a rough outline of what the main character of the book should look like. And depending on the book, if the main character is just a guy, then I don't really worry about it too much. But if the main character is like an animal, like Becky the Throat Goat or Clip Clop the Racist Horse Cop or something like that, then I'll have my artist draw 3 or 4 iterations, and I pay him for each one of them just, you know, so I can have some to throw away. Yeah. And then I pick one of the iterations, and then we say, okay, this is the character that's locked in. And then here's all the descriptions for the 20 to 30 pages that the book will look like. The artist goes off into his little cave and creates all the images for me, and that can take up to 2 weeks, depending on how creative and lazy he feels, because, you know, as we're all, you know, bound by our ability to do stuff, sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's hard. So it can take 2 to 3 weeks maximum, and then he presents me, like just today he dropped all the images for a new book on me, and he usually sends sketches along the way for approval. And then he drops all the images in a folder. And once those images are done, I will copy and paste the rough draft rhyming scheme into the book formatting tool that I use. And I'll add the images into the book formatting tool. And then what I do is I usually read it to I read it out loud a number of times. And I find all the places where I start ad-libbing. Like if I start putting in and, or if I start putting in, you know, taking out words or changing words because they sound better as I'm speaking them, I'll type, you know, I'll go in and I'll fix that as much as I can. And then I upload it to Amazon and publish it the next day.
Very nice. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know about the reading out loud part, but that can totally make sense because, you know, what sound might sound good on the page might not sound right out loud. And that you know, with your success on Omegle and TikTok and YouTube, that's kind of where these live and thrive, I think.
Yeah, I mean, they said those videos of me reading the books is how I sell the books. So, you know, each one of these videos I create is basically a commercial for the book. I show you every page, so there's no surprises when you're buying it. But making sure that it sounds good as I read it is important because I also do it as part of my stand-up. So when I'm in comedy clubs, you know, halfway through I'll do half of my set will be jokes, and then the other half will be me reading books. And I want it to sound good as I'm reading it out loud because not everybody can see the pages. Not everybody can read what I'm writing. They can only see from far away that they're cartoons. They may not see all the detail. So it has to sound good to the person in the back of the room.
Nice. How long have you been doing stand up? I worked for a comedy club, had about the past 12 years.
I've been doing stand-up for five. Been doing it for 5 years. I took stand up at Second City in 2012, and I kind of got the bug for it, but I had a lot to unwind and a lot to unravel between then and now. And so I kind of had to sell my businesses and blow up my life a little bit before I could go balls deep into stand up comedy, which is what I do now, stand up. And sometimes I tell the joke, you know. Gary Shandling told this joke a long time ago, and I've kind of adopted it because it's for him, it was a joke. For me, it's truth. But I always say I'm a stay-at-home comedian, you know, because I like to be in my basement and do everything on YouTube. I do go out to clubs and I do stand up, but that's kind of the I just do that as a like an extracurricular activity or a side hustle. This is the here in the basement is where the money gets made.
It's fun to see the your basement in person because I've seen it in so many videos, all your many comic books. And is that the cucumber from the book, the green plushie back there?
Yeah, that's Cucumber Curtis.
Nice.
Yeah, I have a Becky the Throat goat puppet, a Clip Clop the Racist Horse Cop puppet. And there's a new character coming out this week called Humpy the Pig. There'll be a puppet for him as well.
Interesting. So what I can assume that's what the pig does is hump.
Yeah, he gets STDs.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Now, where is I about to go with that? So you mentioned throat goat and the racist horse. What are there any subjects that are off limits when you're trying to put something together?
No.
No.
Everything's on limits. Everything's within reach. I'm not a I haven't found a subject yet. I mean, you know, nothing has been too crazy for me. And I've learned that everybody's happy until you find their thing, right? And so you can have a fan for 2 years and then one day they'll be like, this one crossed the line. This is where I've lost you, you know, and they and so it's almost a game for me to see, you know, how I can trigger somebody who liked me for a couple of years. And like where are we going to find? Because when people say, you know, you crossed the line, my favorite thing to say back to them is, no, we crossed your line. We found your line. We haven't found mine yet.
It doesn't sound like you have one.
I don't.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm Gen X. Nothing shocks me. Nothing, nothing's, nothing's crazy to me. Nothing is too nuts for me.
Now, as an entrepreneur, because you started years ago with your first book, that was nothing like this. What was that called? The Chronic Marketer. Tell us about that book and like kind of your entrepreneurial journey.
I've always owned my own business since I was 24. I worked a couple jobs along the way. I worked in restaurants. I've worked some hustle work. I've done some hustle jobs, you know, loading trucks, delivering furniture, sales, you know, telemarketing, all the jobs that people without a high school diploma can get, I've had. When I was 24, a good friend of mine who lived next door to me was an artist. A wildlife artist, And he sort of was the first person to show me that you could do something on your own and not necessarily have a boss. And so I started my own businesses when I was from 19 to 24. I had little side businesses. You know, I had a t-shirt company, you know, stuff you do when you're a teenager and you think is going to be the thing. But I learned a lot doing that. I also learned a lot working for my dad for a couple of years. He had his own furniture store. And when I was 24, I started my first online business, and I made a lot of money in that business for, you know, for 10 years. I did very well for myself. I built a small little empire, and never looked back to having a job. And mainly because I don't deal well with authority. So I'm not highly educated. I'm not really employable, so to speak. I'm not the kind of person who could easily get a job. So it actually was easier for me to have a business. And a lot of people are like, oh, it's hard to start a business. It was harder for me to have a job. So I had this business, and then in 2012, I decided to write a book, because I was well known as this person who could make rain on the internet. So like companies would come to me and they would give me like a percentage of their business or a big consulting fee or something else, advisory role or whatever, that, you know, seat on the board, whatever that looked like, in exchange for what they used to call growth hacking. And I never really liked the term growth hacking, but basically it was, you know, I could come into a new startup business and I could see what you were doing, and I could tell you right away if you were going to succeed or if you were going to fail. And if you weren't going to succeed, I wouldn't have even worked with you, but I could tell you, you know, this isn't for me, or this is for me. And if it is for me, I could, like, the path from your idea to 100,000 customers for me was clear and present, and I could get it every time. And so I had this kind of special, you know, what we'll call it, like, autistic dyslexic skill, where I wasn't very good at a lot of things, but I could see the success and the path to it for your business or for my own business. And so I wrote a book in 2012 called Chronic Marketer: Confessions of a Highly Paid, but I can't remember what it was even called. Confessions of a Highly Paid Internet Marketer or something. What was the tagline? Do you have it there? I can't remember the tagline.
I just put Chronic Marketer.
Okay. And it had a cartoon of me smoking a joint on the cover, and it was tongue in cheek. Same kind of style as what I do now, you know, cartoons, humor was injected into the book. It had a lot more words than my normal books now, but, you know, cause it was a proper, you know, 250 page paperback or whatever. And, so that book was kind of born from those skill sets. And I wanted to show people my thought process and how I did what I did as best as I possibly could through storytelling and through examples, and kind of just a little bit of a peek behind my eyeballs into my brain a little bit. And that book became a bestseller. I self-published this book, and the audience was pothead entrepreneurs. And in 2012, nobody was talking to those people. You know, marijuana was still illegal everywhere. You know, this was before the legalization boom kind of hit. And I treated my own book like I treated a lot of the businesses that I worked with. And I said, okay, here's a market nobody's talking to. I used to go to these business conferences and meet people who were highly successful that like to get high in the hotel room after the show, you know? And so I thought, nobody's really talking to this group. You know, I've met lawyers that like to get high and smoke weed and, you know, at the Holiday Inn at some conference, or, you know, the Marriott or whatever. And they go out back. And I thought, nobody's talking to these people. Like, nobody's speaking directly to them. So I wrote this book by sort of saying, hey, I thought the cool thing would be, all right, I'm going to show you what I do, and it'll hit two different audiences. It'll hit the audience of people who, like me at the time, liked to get high and, you know, somehow that helped my thought process. I don't smoke anymore, but I did at the time. And then the other audience were the people who are like, well, if that pothead stoner can do it, so can I, you know? So I kind of was able to get these two audiences together. And by highly targeting them, you know, I targeted on Facebook, like, you know, people who liked High Times and liked bong companies and people who identified as entrepreneurs. And when you can find an audience, especially early days of Facebook marketing, when you can find an audience that nobody was talking to, the cost per click on that audience is next to nothing, like a penny, you know what I mean? And so I was able to build a list of customers and launch my book as a bestseller day one. And I launched it 14 years ago, April 20th, 2012. So, and the day it launched, it was a bestseller. As a self-publisher, that's pretty hard to do. And not just a bestseller in some random category, but like made it to the top 40 of all Amazon products that day. You know, I beat Pete Townsend's book, you know, launch. I beat like celebrity book launches that day. And I was pretty proud of that. And it's a long story, but essentially what happened was I started to get all these speaking opportunities. You know, conferences were asking me to fly out to London, England, and, you know, all over the US and Canada and Italy and, you know, all these different places to talk about my process, but also talk about how I became a self-published bestseller, because that was a big deal at the time. Nobody had really pulled that off. And so I took stand-up comedy at Second City so that I could be a better public speaker. And I loved comedy. I was always, anytime I went to if I'd go to Vegas, I would always get tickets to a comedy show. I love stand-up. I always have. And so to me, this was a natural thing. And I took stand-up comedy at Second City, and I instantly loved this craft and this process and the idea that I could just get on stage and entertain you and not educate you. I didn't have to dump any data on you. I just had to make you laugh. And so I did it, and I loved it. And I knew right then and there that that's what I was going to do with my life. But it wasn't, the timing wasn't right. I had a business to run. My ex-wife was not going to be any part of me being a comedian. So I had to get, I had to basically sell my business, sell my house, divorce my wife, and change my, you know, blow up my life, as I say, to get to do what I want, which is I wanted to be a comedian.
And sometimes you have to do that, or it will blow it up itself, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The years I've seen, it's happened both ways. You know, they've thrived or it's imploded.
Yeah.
Tell us about that Second City experience. Like, was it strictly stand up, or was there some improv classes?
It was strictly stand up. I'm not an improv guy. I don't have the energy for improv. I'm a very, like, I can't even host. Like, sometimes I'll do comedy shows and they'll say, "Can you host?" I'm like, "No, I can't. I'm not that. I don't have that kind of energy, and I definitely don't have improv energy." So it was purely stand up, and it was purely sort of understanding the structure of jokes and the how to be a comic on stage, and how, you know, excuse me, understanding the rules about not running the light and all this other kind of stuff. It was more sort of a crash course in the craft and the technical side and the etiquette of being a good professional stand-up comic.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool. Who inspires you, like, comedically, stand-up wise?
I am a big fan of Dave Attell, Jimmy Carr, Anthony Jeselnik, Bert Kreischer, and Tom Segura mostly. I'm sure there's some others that I'm not thinking of. Neil Brennan, I love his podcast. I love his kind of, he takes his mental health approach to stuff, which I really like. So yeah, it, you know, I watch most comedians. I've seen all the specials. I've gone to so many, you know, comics shows when they come to the city, or if I'm traveling, I'll go see them. And I find each one has kind of a style that you pull from. And then there's another comic who's dead now, Bob Einstein. He was Super Dave Osborne.
Yeah.
And I always liked his style of, not even because he didn't do a lot of stand up, but when he would do talk shows, his ability to keep a straight face and to look disappointed and annoyed all the time is definitely kind of a spirit that I embrace.
Yeah, you definitely have that same vibe to you, for sure. What situations are most creative for you? So, like, once you get that idea, do some come easier? How does that process and flow?
I don't have a process. I'm frantic about taking notes. I don't sit down to write. I have tried this exercise where, you know, like I know Jerry Seinfeld talks a lot about, you know, schedule out the time and sit down with your pen and paper and write. I can't do that. I can't force myself to come up with stuff, but I know that I have these little bursts of brilliance, and when they hit me, I have to, and sometimes it's as I put my head on my pillow. Sometimes it's halfway through watching a movie or watching a stand-up special or a podcast on YouTube, or I'm in my car and I have to stop everything and write down the idea, because I know that if I don't write it down, I'll forget it. And so really my process is about taking notes through stream of consciousness, and right when that nugget kind of hits, I'll write down as much as I can, or I'll put in my notes app as much as I can. And that allows me to just stop thinking about it and know that I've got it on paper or I've got it on my notes app and I can come back to it later. So that's really it for me, is just they come to me, and I don't know how they come to me. But they do. And when they do, I drop everything to make sure that I write them down.
So from the book to the conferences, to the stand up, you know, that, and that goes the process from, you know, the stand up to when the first book, and then when the books, you know, blew up.
Sorry, what's the question?
Oh, sorry. From, you know, when you were doing stand up, and then when you did the books, what was that little span of time in between there?
I did the books first.
Oh, okay.
So I started the books about 5 years ago. I did them in 2019, the end of 2019. Okay. So, you know, 4.5 years ago. And I started making TikToks and, you know, YouTube videos, and you know, I was trying to be funny and making jokes, and some of them were doing okay, and some of them were getting taken down for community guidelines violations, and some of them were hitting. And, you know, the story I always tell is I started off with a cover of a book that never existed called Why Daddy Hits Mommy, A Kid's Guide to Understanding Alcoholism. And I went on TikTok and I said, my name's Brad Goss. I write books for children, but my publisher keeps rejecting them, which is where the rejected children's books kind of came from. And I said, why do you think they rejected this one? And I showed the cover, and, you know, this terrible cover of this man beating his wife in the living room. And that video got 1.5 million views. And most of the comments were people asking for to see the whole book. Well, you know, read it to us. Let us hear it. And I hadn't written it. So obviously with that many views, I thought, okay, well, I can write this. And so I wrote the pages in Dr. Seuss style without illustrating the pages, without publishing the book. It hadn't clicked yet that this was going to be a thing. Yeah. And then I held up the cover and I read the book without showing you any pages or saying, or, and it wasn't for sale. And that did really well. And it was just this, you know, Dr. Seuss style dark humor poem. And that's when the light went on. I started reading the comments. That video got 1 million and whatever views. And I read the comments and they were all, you know, where is this book, and show us the pages and all this kind of stuff. And that's when I thought, oh my God, I got to publish this. And so I illustrated it with clip art. I had a clip art company at the time. And so I illustrated it with my own clip art. And I had my clip art company had weird clip art, including domestic violence clip art. And so I was able to kind of throw this book together, you know, it was easy to do because I had access to the content. And I thought, oh, this would be a great advertisement for my business. You know, here's a book that I made with the clip art. And And so the third iteration of the video was me reading the book, showing you the pages, and then at the end telling you that it's available on Amazon, because I knew how to self-publish. I learned that in 2012. And so, and then I saw the sales needle move. And it wasn't gangbusters like it is now. It was okay, but it was enough to give me a taste that there's something here. You know, I'm very keen on, like, if I can figure out how to make a dollar today with minimal effort, then I can figure out how to make $1 million with, you know, massive action and concentrated effort.
Beautiful. I thought of a question while you were talking and how I lost it. Hopefully it'll come back to me. Let's see. What is your favorite part and least favorite part about these books and, you know, all the promotion and social media that comes with it?
My favorite part is the money. I love money. So that's my favorite part, is the success and the money that comes with it. My least favorite part is probably dealing with social media commenters and people who want to criticize or critique or try to push my buttons. I treat everybody who's mean to me on social media like a heckler, and they don't like it. So, you know, it sometimes I have to go to a negative space to deal with people, and it, you know, I'm kind of going through a personal development audit right now and trying to respond to less hate online. But my problem is that I enjoy agitating angry people. So it's kind of this double-edged sword where, like, it comes back to haunt me, but I still like doing it. And, you know, but I'm learning to do it less, because I see the most successful people do not engage, and engaging has gotten me this far. So it's hard for me to disconnect from it. But, you know, the reality, Dylan, is that I have a small percentage of people who think that I am actually targeting the children, right? They think that I'm actually trying to make children into swingers, and I'm trying to tell children that their dads are a cuck, and I'm, you know, and that I believe that polyamory is for children and that they should learn about it. And those people, you know, I get death threats from those people. I get, you know, like, they call the police. They, you know, they share my stuff and they put false headlines in it. Like, these books are already in your kid's library at the school, you know? And so they really kind of rage bait this content. And that has also helped me. Again, this is one of these things where it's like, I love it and I hate it at the same time, you know, but and I have a thick skin for this. So I say this is the part that I hate the most, but it's also the part that I know that I get some value out of. And so I get how it's necessary. But, you know, if you had said to me when I took my first stand-up comedy class, hey, Brad, you're going to be really good at this. You're going to have 2 million followers. You're going to sell, you know, a shit ton of books, enough to pay for a house and have a nice lifestyle. However, every day somebody's going to call you a pedophile. I'd be okay with that. And so I am okay with that. But it's also kind of frustrating how absolutely stupid people can be. And, you know, so it's, and the funny thing is that as a comic, it's really hard, because when someone says, why are you targeting children? I can't just be Brad Goss and say, I'm not targeting kids. What? Come on. This is for adults, because that's not fun. If they say, why are you targeting children? I say, because children are the future. You know, I lean in, I commit to the bit, and I let them get more angry, which creates all kinds of problems for me, but I keep doing it because I just don't know any other way of dealing with someone who's that stupid, is to just push the gas pedal on how dumb you are. So when people call me a pedophile, You know, I usually just respond with "Don't be a snowflake," or because I know the people calling me a pedophile hate the phrase. Like, I don't even use the term snowflake in my normal lifestyle, but it's like I know that you're the type of person who gets offended and triggered by the word snowflake, so I call you a snowflake just because I know it's going to piss you off more. And so I have this like, I can't stop pushing these people's buttons. Even if I wanted to, I don't know that I could. Because it's kind of fun to like put you in a jar and shake it and watch you lose your mind. And the thing is that, you know, if somebody likes you on social media, they'll say, "Oh my God, that was so funny." And I'll like their comment and I'll respond with, "Thank you so much." Or they'll say, "I bought your book," and I'll say, "Thank you for your support." And that is the end of our interaction. But if you say, "Why are you targeting children?" And I say, "Because children need to learn about polyamory, or because children are the future, or because I love children," that's going to create the engagement levels that creates, the amount of back and forth that I can have a 120 reply exchange with somebody, and that boosts my engagement numbers on social media. So, you know, it's a long answer to your question, but I really, you know, I love the money. I don't love the angry people, but I know how necessary they are, and so I shake the jar.
And then just being so stupid that they don't take that extra step to see what the product actually is.
Once you decide something, once you think to yourself, like you kind of put this in your head that this is what this is, it's very hard for anybody to change their mind. They don't want, they're in confirmation bias territory. They do not want their mind changed. Like most people who are fighting on the internet do not want to change their mind. So even when presented, like I've seen it on Twitter where people will lose their mind and they'll be like, "This man's a pedophile. We need to, you know, we need to have him arrested. He's reading these to children." And then someone will respond and say, "No, Brad Goss is a comedian. Here's his bio. He knows exactly what he's doing. Triggering you is part of his routine." You know, they will not. Nobody ever says, "Oh, wow. Oh, I feel dumb now." Nobody ever does that. Like, they're just like, "No, he's a pedophile." Like, they have to stay. Now they have to be right. And that's how the internet works, right? There's two irrefutable facts about the internet, right? Everybody has an opinion that doesn't change, and single moms need cock.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Speaking of online, you saw a lot of success on Omegle, and that met its demise last year.
Yeah.
Tell us about your adventures on there and, you know, how you felt when they turned it off.
I loved Omegle, but there are also other platforms. So now there are three or four other ones where you can do the same thing. And Omegle got shut down because they couldn't keep up with the lawsuits and they weren't making enough money to pay a team of lawyers. But they basically got shut down because they were the place where predators met prey. You know, you could find your abuser on Omegle. And so it got shut down, which means they should also shut down Central Park. You know, the reality is that there are a lot of places where evil exists and where evil finds innocence and corrupts it. That's just the way the world works. And some places it's easier for that to happen. Omegle was one of those places. So is a dark alley. So is the shopping mall, you know, so is the bus. So I think that its demise is a blow to freedom. It's a bit of a hit to freedom. I think it's unfair that you know, so many lawsuits were levied against the platform, when the reality is, if your child was groomed on that platform, that's 100% on you for not supervising your kids' activities online. And nobody is to blame but your shitty parenting for that to happen. And if you are an adult and you met an abuser on there, again, that's on you. Like, you're going to meet that same abuser on Tinder. You're going to meet that same abuser in Plenty of Fish. Those people exist everywhere. And shutting down the meeting place is not going to stop the evil. So I enjoyed it because it was a especially during the pandemic when there were no comedy clubs, you know, hosting shows here in Toronto. We were in lockdown here for the longest time. Omegle was a good place for me to do crowd work and to film reaction, you know, content to my books. And This was early days. Nobody knew what I was doing. It's a little bit different now. Like, I go on these platforms now and they're like, "Hey, it's the book guy. Read me a book." You know, they know who I am. But before that, I could say, "Try not to laugh challenge." And they had no idea who I was. And they'd be like, "Okay, let's do this." You know, and then I would say, I write books for children. I'm going to show you a few. You're going to pick one. I'm going to read it to you like you're fucking five. And then they'd look at me weirdly. And then I'd pull up these titles. And then you just, you know, you'd get this magical surprise and they would laugh. Yeah. That happens less and less for me now because I've become known for what I do. And those many people now see me, you know, they see the background, they see me, they're like, that's the guy that writes the books on TikTok. Read me a story, bro. You know? And I still get laughs out of that, but the kind of magic of the surprise is still there for a handful of people, but it's not as nice as it was in the early days when nobody knew what I was doing.
Nice. Speaking of reading, is there anything that you have or would like to read to us today?
I don't have really anything here at my desk right at the moment. So
no worries. I put you on the spot.
Unfortunately not, but I mean, it's everywhere on my YouTube and TikTok and Instagram. Yeah. It's ad nauseum, so you can find it.
Nice. Just thought I'd ask. Now, to close out the show, I have a series of bonus questions to have a little fun on the way out. The first one's a little bit serious. What does creativity mean to you?
Freedom. It means trying... It means having the freedom to try everything and anything that I want to try. But it also means for me, I approach it like a business. So I'm a creative person, but I don't value creativity over and above my business very much. I buy art. I love art. You know, I support artists. I love music. I love all things creativity. But as a creative person, it really, I don't know that I would be creative if it wasn't for the money. So I am sort of the anti-creative, because there's a lot of creatives out there that are like, money's not important. You know, I don't want it. So being creative to me, or creativity to me, is an outlet for me to test things that see what makes me the most money.
Gotcha. The next one. Who is your favorite Muppet and why?
My favorite Muppet.
Anything Jim Henson created.
Yeah. I'm thinking probably the two old men in the balcony, you know, that moan and bitch about everything. I kind of like them. And then maybe the Swedish Chef.
Nice. No, those are good answers. A lot of people pick the two grumpy guys. So, and then in the movie of your life, who would you like to play you, and what genre would the film be?
I would like Anne Hathaway to play me. And no, I'm kidding. I think everybody tells me that I look like Rainn Wilson. So probably Rainn Wilson, what's the guy that's married to Susan Sarandon? He was in
Tim Robbins.
A lot of people tell me I look like him. So probably one of those two, just because I'm told they look like me. But I think the genre would probably be dark humor, dark comedy.
Yeah. On another podcast, you said Death to Smoochie is like your favorite comedy movie. So probably like in that vein.
Yeah, along those lines.
Awesome. Where can the world find you? You know, what's your socials, and where can they buy the books?
Just Brad Gosse, Gosse. Google it and you'll find everything. I have all the same social media handles I've been using. You know, bradgosse.com, Brad Gosse on all the socials. Amazon, search for Brad Gosse. Everything is Brad Gosse. Easy.
And I just thought of this one. Do you have a dream project? Is there like something that you would like to do and it's just kind of sitting out there and you're working towards it?
Yeah, I would love to have, I have two dream projects, really. One of them is a Netflix special. Maybe not necessarily stand up in a theater like you see a lot of Netflix specials, but maybe something more like Bo Burnham Inside. But the other idea for me would be some type of animated series for like Adult Swim or Comedy Central, or I know National Lampoon is rebooting right now. So, you know, some of those platforms I think would be, or even Netflix would be good for me to, you know, I feel like I have this kind of multiverse of characters that would work well together in a weird sort of South Park-ish kind of environment. And but it's hard to do animation on your own. So the dream project would be to have a, you know, some backing and a studio come in and help me do it.
So the throat go-diverse?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Very nice. Well, thank you, Brad, for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dylan.
The podcast is done, man.